What I did to others, and what others did to me. In the city, the line between nightmare and reality was fluid, just as the context of the words killer and death had shifted over time. Perhaps Mord was responsible. Perhaps we all were. A killer was someone who killed for reasons other than survival. A killer was a madman or madwoman, not a person just trying to get through another day. Once I hit a woman with a rock. We encountered each other while out scavenging on the same deserted street on the west side of the city. I had found a smooth piece of metal being absorbed by a glistening red piece of flesh-like plant. I didn't know if Wick would find it useful, but I had never seen anything like it before. As I turned a corner, holding my prize, I came upon a woman walking. She was about 50, wiry in the way survivors often are, gray hair hanging in a sheet, clothing a patchwork of gray and black. She saw me and smiled. Then she saw what I held, and her smile went away. "Give me that. That's mine." Maybe she meant, "That's going to be mine." I didn't wait for her to get close enough to grapple with me. I knelt and picked up a rock with my free hand. As she rushed toward me from the middle of the street, I threw it at her, catching her in the forehead. She went limp, fell onto her side, breathing heavily. Then she got up, and I threw another rock, catching her in the head again. This time she staggered back, put her hands on her knees as she hunched down. I could see the bright red pooling from her head to the ground. She sat heavily in the rubble and put a hand to her head, stared at me as I dropped the third rock I'd picked up.
"I just wanted to look at it," she said, puzzled as she kept putting a hand to her wound and taking it away again.
Her eyes began to glaze over.
"Just a look is all I wanted."
I didn't stay to help her or hurt her. I left. Did she die? Did I kill her? And if I did, am I a murderer? What happened between the woman and me wasn't new. No matter how much amnesia we've suffered, it was as old as the old world and older still. The first rule, the only rule, is that you carry your safety with you the best you can. You protect yourself the best you can. And you have that right. But one evening, 3 weeks after I found Bourne, I let down my guard. A gang of children creeping through the moss and detritus caught the door behind me before it shut, followed me, silent, down the corridors to my apartment, keeping to my same path to avoid the traps and pheromones and attack spiders. I didn't notice because I was already thinking about Bourne and wondering where I would find him this time. Wick had left to tend to the farthest reach of his crumbling drug empire. None of my personal defenses, predator cockroaches in the hallway, the crab spiders embedded in the door, a good old-fashioned knife blade, could stop them. Other than Mord, the poison rains, and the odd discarded biotech that could cause death or discomfort, the young were often the most terrible force in the city. Nothing in their gaze could tell you they were human. They had no memories of the old world to anchor them or humble them or inspire them. Their parents were probably dead or worse, and the most terrible and transformative violence had been visited upon them from the earliest of ages. There were 5 of them, and 4 had traded their eyes for green-gold wasps that curled into their sockets and compounded their vision. Claws graced their hands like sharp commas. Scales at their throats burned red when they breathed. One wing sighed bellows-like out of the naked back of the shortest, the one who still had slate-gray human eyes. After a while, I wished he'd had wasps instead. They smelled of brine and sweat and dust.
They licked their lips and flexed their biceps like little conquerors. At that time, we did not know how they had become so changed, unless it was from contamination from the company, and could not identify the new impulse rising, nor where it came from. I fought, but sometimes fighting isn't enough. Showing aggression and resistance isn't enough. You can't blame yourself for being outnumbered if you want to stay sane. It was useless. I was useless. They tortured me in various unimaginative ways for hours. The shortest mostly just watched, stood beside the bed with his slate-gray gaze shining dull from huge eyes, the whites not as white as his pale skin. They were on drugs they'd probably found on a toxic waste heap. Between my whimpers and screams and thrashing, as the sheets grew red and the other three howled their dominance, I kept saying to the gray-eyed child, "Don't watch, don't watch." I wanted to believe I was trying to spare him, but I was really trying to spare myself. It was too late for him. When they began to tire of their games, they broke everything not of value, stood on one another's shoulders to snuff out my fireflies. Then they found Bourne. He must have moved or somehow attracted their attention. Soon their interest in me faded. On their way out, they decided to take Bourne with them. Through one bleary, blood-encrusted eye, I saw them snatch him up. That was the first time I pleaded with them, when they took Bourne. That was the first time I truly knew Bourne was important to me. But it didn't matter. They took Bourne and left me in the dark, cheek laid open, face and arms and legs bleeding, some of the wounds deep. My skin burned, my skin was numb, my open flesh felt cold against the heat. I didn't have the strength to get up. The city had visited me, to remind me that I meant less than nothing to it, that even the balcony cliffs wasn't safe, that every wire in my head connected to our defenses could be snapped, just like that. Time passed, and I existed in a quivering, exposed, horrible state. I was howling and shrieking, and there was nothing of restraint left in me. The pain took care of that. When I came to for the third or fourth time, my head lay upon Wick's lap, and he was looking down at me with a curious expression on his face. His body flickered a light green with his stress, a side effect of giving a home to the diagnostic worms. My body felt soft and warm as he tended to me, with an ache behind it that threatened to become all-consuming. "I'm so sorry," Wick said in a quiet voice, as if talking to a corpse. The concern I hadn't seen in him came through in his voice, so thick and heartfelt, as if he had been crying, that it transfixed me, became something horrifying. I didn't need his devastation, but his strength. "Just lie still. You shouldn't feel pain for a while." I did feel pain. Muted, yes, but I felt it. But I nodded to give us both comfort. My vision blurring as I stared up at him. I could still make out the precise and beautiful architecture of his face. God help me. That still mattered to me. He ran a diagnostic beetle over my body. It was old and worn, its carapace scratched, but its legs felt smooth, glossy. Everywhere it touched me, I felt an immediate, fast-fading, glowing sensation. Wick had already closed up my wounds with the help of surgical slugs. I remembered the cool, cold sensation of their progress from the last time I had suffered an injury. My attackers had been creative, had cut me in patterns, writing words that had no meaning to anyone, least of all them. And so the movement of the slugs had retraced those paths, those words,
given them a meaning by accident.
I would hold you, Wick said from far away, but I'm afraid I would hurt you.
Then I remembered they had taken Bourne and wanted to ask Wick,
what, to go after them?
But Wick told me not to speak, said,
I'm sorry I wasn't here. I'm sorry they got through.
He was in a different place than me, worried about different things.
How badly did they hurt you?
He asked then, with a particular emphasis, and I knew what he was really asking. The question was medical, but not medical. He had been recreating my attack in his imagination and seeing the worst, and he needed to know just how invasive to be with his diagnostics.
Just what you see, I said, and there was a noticeable relaxation of Wick's taut stance that somehow agitated me.
My attackers had been too single-minded or too inhuman to rape me. The one with the gray eyes, the oldest, had been about 11 years old, with sandy blonde hair and delicate hands. I might not have told Wick the truth even if they had, but they hadn't. Two of the wasp eyes had shoved their tongues in my mouth as they cut me, but it had been as if trying to contaminate me with something. A metallic aftertaste still lingered on my tongue. Now I was crying. Just a steady stream of tears without the expression on my face changing at all. There is only so much you can take before you begin to feel that the effort to survive is too much to endure. It would have been better if I had been attacked in the street. It would have been better if I lay out there now in a heap than to lie in the middle of the balcony cliffs and have to absorb Wick's guilt, his concern, his regard. To be seen, when all I wanted was to crawl away into a dark hole to die or recover from my wounds. But I let Wick do his work, and also told him how it had happened, so he would know how to bolster our defenses. I was alive, and from past experience I knew, in time, I would forget enough to again pretend that we could someday be free. Of the city, of Mord, of all of it. I don't know if that was hope. Maybe it was just stubborn inertia.
And they took Bourne, too, I said a little later, not sure my words were coming out right.
Bourne being gone was a concept I had to think around, or I wouldn't make it. Wick frowned from the chair next to my bed.
But they didn't take Bourne.
He nodded toward the living room.
He's right in there.
Even through my numb discomfort, the beetle crawling across my torso, I felt an overwhelming confusion and relief. Did they bring him back?
I don't think so. He was in the hallway by the door. Your attackers got away. I brought him back in.
Thank you, I said, knowing that might not have been an easy decision.
He's bigger, Wick said.
I said nothing. I didn't dare. For the first time, I realized Wick looked worried or preoccupied for reasons that might have nothing to do with me. I'd managed to keep Wick away from Bourne for 2 straight weeks. The beetle had finished its work. Wick got to his feet.
You need to rest. I've brought food for the kitchen. I've put up better defenses. I have to go out for a while, but I'll be back soon.
I understood. He needed to make sure my attackers were really gone. He had to change the locks, make sure no one else could enter the same way, all of which meant eating up more resources we didn't have, putting us both at risk much sooner. The burn, the sting, the screaming agony of what had happened would not return for hours, as if it was coming toward me from light years distant. I extended my arm to touch Wick's cheek, the edge of his mouth,
but he was too far away.
I should have been here, he said.
If you hadn't come back, I might be dead, I said, but this was no comfort. If the city had really wanted to kill me, it would have killed me, as it had so many others.
I should take Bourne with me, Wicks said, trying to sound casual. I winced.
No, please, don't.
It would have been better for Wicks' peace of mind if I had shouted it out or said it just as casual, but I didn't. I said those three words in a small, broken voice, and Wick couldn't push back against them. At some point after Wick left, I realized I couldn't sleep and decided to get up. It hurt, but I was already restless, unused to bed rest. I wanted to go see Bourne. In my altered state, I worried my attackers might have injured him as well. Or maybe I just wanted to be sure Wick hadn't taken him away. He sat on a chair at the kitchen table, pulsing a faint green gold. Wick had restored a few of my fireflies, but not many, so all I could really see was the glow of Bourne. Bourne stood at least half a foot taller than that afternoon, his base thicker and more robust. On the chair, he came up to my shoulders. I couldn't see that any harm had come to him. He still had that perfect symmetry. He was beautiful in that darkness. He was powerful.
It's just me, Bourne said.
I screamed. I stumbled back looking for a weapon, a stick, a knife, anything. His voice sounded just like the rasp of the boy with the gray eyes.
Just me, Bourne said. Bourne.
Just me. The worms Wick had left inside me struggled to release the drugs that would calm me. I was shaking. I was making an uncontrollable sound.
It's just me, Bourne said again, as if testing out the words.
I flinched again, stayed up against the far wall. This time he sounded less like my attacker, warmer and more lyrical, what I would come to know as his normal voice, although he could assume many.
Rachel, Bourne said, don't need to be afraid.
The gray-eyed boy's voice was completely gone now.
Don't tell me what I need to be, I shouted at him. What are you?
He began to shamble off the chair.
Don't come closer. Stay the fuck away.
I struggled for more words to fill the space between us. Into that gap, Bourne said,
go rest. Please rest. Don't worry. Sleep.
I could tell Bourne had to consider each word carefully before choosing one, unsure how they fit together.
Sleep? I laughed bitterly. I'm not going to sleep now. You're talking to me.
I am Bourne, said the thing in front of me. I talking, talking, talking.
Those words came out in a kind of mellifluous burble that reminded me of how much he had amused me those past weeks.
But where did those words come from? Bourne still had no face, no real mouth.
Is this a dream?
Dream?
Bourne said.
How did you escape them?
Them?
Bourne said. Yes, them. The children who attacked me.
Children, Bourne said. Attacked me.
I was drifting then. Drifting against my will, swaying as the medical creatures inside worked on me. I staggered, knew I was sliding down the wall onto my butt. The worms must have decided I needed sleep. Everything became fuzzy, indistinct. After a time, I had a sense of Bourne's shape looming over me, of things crawling around inside my veins. I was in my bed. I was on the floor. I was in the living room, awake, asleep, suspended between, delirious, raving, wondering if I was in a nightmare or just now entering one. All the things in my past that I tried not to think about rose to the surface, spilled out of my mouth, and Bourne stood there, listening. I told him everything about me. Things I hadn't admitted to myself that had been bottled up for so long I had no control over them. I couldn't know it then, but what I offered up to Bourne probably saved my life. Where I came from and who I was. Once it was different. Once people had homes and parents and went to schools. Cities existed within countries, and those countries had leaders. Travel could be for adventure or recreation, not survival. But by the time I was grown up, the wider context was a sick joke. Incredible how a slip could become a free fall, and a free fall could become a hell where we lived on as ghosts in a haunted world. Once at the age of 8 or 9, I had still wanted to be a writer, or at least something other than a refugee. Not a trap maker, not a scavenger, not a killer. I filled my notebooks full of scribbles. Poetry about how I loved the sea, retellings of fables, even scenes from novels I never finished and will never finish. Bourne could have been a creature out of those childhood fictions. Bourne could have been my imaginary friend. I rationalized later that this is why I told Bourne about my past. Why I told him what I could never tell Wick, just as he could not tell me about a diagram, a hidden history of the city, the Nautilus biotech. But maybe it could have been anyone in that moment. I was born on an island that fell not to war or disease, but to rising seas. My father was a politician of sorts, a member of the council that ruled the largest island of the archipelago. He liked to fish and build things in his spare time. He collected old nautical maps and liked to find the errors. He had a boat that he built himself called the Turtle Shell. He used to take my mother out for floating picnics while he courted her, land just a dot on the horizon. "I must have trusted him," my mother said when he told the story. "I must have really trusted him to go so far out at sea." My mother had been born on the island too, but her people came from far away, from the mainland, and it was a scandal when the two of them married because it wasn't ever done. That scandal gave me my name, Rachel, because it came from neither family but from outsiders, a compromise. My mother was a doctor who took care of infants. She was quick to smile and laugh, perhaps too quick, because she would laugh when nervous or distressed, too. I could see my father observe her carefully, perhaps to make sure of the difference. She liked the spicy food of her family's homeland and took up making little models of ships. She would playfully mock my father's fascination with boats using her models. Scale versions with toothpicks. Like my father, she loved to read, and books surrounded me growing up. We had what we wanted and more. We knew who we were, but that could not stop the rising seas, and one by one, the smaller islands around us winked out of existence. We could see their lights at night with our telescope, standing on the shore. And then came the nights when we could no longer see those lights. We had known before that, but after that, we put away the telescope. I was only 6 when we left, boarding a ship as refugees, I remember, because my parents told me the stories as I grew up. They told me the stories even as we continued to be refugees, moving from camp to camp, country to country, thinking that we could outrun the unraveling of the world. But the world was unraveling most places. I still have vague memories of the camps, the ever-present mud churned to muck by overcrowding, of mosquitoes so thick you had to keep your mouth shut, of extreme heat balanced later by extreme cold, the fences and guard dogs that always seemed better tended to than the tents, the new papers we needed to apply for, the old ones that were never good enough, the cast-off biotech they shoveled into troughs for us, and the way phones and other devices became extinct over time. The feeling of always being hollowed out and hungry, sickness, and always having a cold or being feverish. The people on the outside, the guards, were the same as us, and I didn't understand why they should be on the outside and we should be on the inside. But also, I remember my parents laughing and sharing things about our home as I became old enough to appreciate them. Photographs, a ceremonial bowl my father insisted on lugging with us, my mother's handmade jewelry, a photo album. Every time we moved and started over, my father would build things, tents or enclosures or vegetable gardens. My mother would pitch in and tend the sick, even though the countries we lived in didn't recognize her medical license. Was it selfless? They were fighting for their lives, their identities. So, no, it was not selfless, but it helped people. My father must have been cheery for my sake, for my mother's sake. She might one day be able to return to a homeland. He could not, and it was rare we met anyone who had lived on the island. The stories he told became boring to me through repetition, but I understand now that he was just trying to fix that place with the compass of his memories. Throughout all of this, my parents did not forget my education. Not a formal education, but the education that mattered. What to value, what to hold on to, what to let go of, what to fight for and what to discard, where the traps were. Once, we found a kind of peace. My father led us to another island, not the same, not at all, but whether from an impulse, futile or courageous or both, he meant to recreate what he had known. We had a good life there for almost 2 years. A city to live in, a beach to walk on, a botanical garden, a school, playing with children who looked like me. We lived in a little two-room apartment, and my dad built in the backyard an outrigger canoe with a cannibalized motor. My mother became a doctor again, working in return for goods. Every so often, information came from the mainland that whatever might have been bad was getting worse. But my parents withheld any news from me for as long as they could, as best as they were able. Until one day, shock, we were herded by soldiers via a crowded, diesel-spewing ferry to the mainland and another camp. The green-blue water and my father's boat and our apartment were gone. It got worse after that, not better. It got worse and kept getting worse until we didn't even have the camps. It was just us, trudging across a land that held pockets of sanity and insanity both. Kindness and cruelty, sometimes from the same source. My father carried a knife in his boot and took turns with my mother holding on to a small revolver. We were as likely to come across burned and half-buried bodies in a ditch as a farmer and his sons armed with shotguns. Once, a grinning man invited us into his house and tried to rape my mother. My father had a scar across his left arm after that, and we would stay off the main roads. We starved at times, rather than join the ranks of those marching toward an illusion, that slow, tired trudge. The back roads we took would become reduced to gray snakes against the blackness of forest or scrubland. In the distance, lights of a cabin or of a town would invoke in us dread and then caution, followed by avoidance. Months after we had stopped believing in refuge, there appeared on a distant hill a city so miraculous it looked at dusk like a huge crystal chandelier that had fallen to earth or a stranded ocean liner listing on its side. I could not keep my eyes off of it and pleaded with my parents to go there. They ignored me. They were right to. It lay on our horizon for several days, and during the night of the ninth day, having rounded its eastern side, still fighting our way through forest and plain, it caught fire. All of those sparkling lights taken up in a huge conflagration that burned the darkness away for miles around. There came the blinking red hazard lights of bombers flying away from the city, and we so far down below marveled at the sight because it had been years since we had seen a plane of any kind, something so old and so new. We wondered if airplanes might mean some resurgence, that some resurrection of a normal life might be upon us. But it was just an illusion. It meant nothing. We made our way quickly more eastward still, fearing the exodus of the survivors as if it were a wave that might drown us, and yet they were no different than us. Then came the thick, powdery black smoke during the days, gathered up in the sooty rain that fell. And out of the ground came writhing worms and rabbits and other dying things. Soon, we would think back kindly on those days. But throughout it all, my parents held on to hope, kept trying to find a safe place. They would not give up. They never gave up. I knew that, even now that they were gone. There was more that I told Bourne, but I can't bring myself to write it, because it is too terrible to put into words, and it pushes up against the one thing I couldn't remember, how I came to this city, what had happened to my parents. My last memories from before the city were of floods and makeshift rafts and the expanding silence of people dead or dying in the water, and a hint of land on the horizon. My last memories were of going down for a second, third time, my lungs full of silt. But when I came to, I was in the city, walking. I was walking by the river as if I had always been there, alone. What I did next, even though it might have been wrong. For every clear-eyed view of my room that took in the lack of running water, the mold that had begun its war against the constellations of fireflies embedded in my ceiling, the half-collapsing wall with the window that looked out on a mountain of dirt, for all of that and the scenes out on the streets of one tired and dirty person fighting another person who was just as tired and dirty over a scrap the old world would have found useless or disgusting, for all of that, I still could imagine a time when the small things we used to love might be returned to us.
"It's just me," Bourne said, and for a long time, huddled on my bed trying to recover, I didn't answer. Not really. I just spewed words at him, lost and rambling. Wick appeared next to him from time to time and winked out again. Sometimes I would feel Wick's arms around me. Sometimes I would see him staring at me with an expression of guilt and, I thought, of suspicion. Was the suspicion because of Bourne? Since the attack, Bourne had changed again.
He had abandoned the sea anemone shape in favor of resembling a large vase or a squid balanced on a flattened mantle. The aperture at the top had curled out and up on what I chose to interpret as a long neck, sprouting feathery filaments, which almost seemed like an affectation. The filaments, with a prolonged soft sigh, would crowd together and then pull apart again like bizarre synchronized dancers. He was tall enough now that the top of him loomed a good 2 feet above the bed. Colors still flitted across his body, or lazily floated in shapes like storm clouds, ragged and layered and dark, azure, lavender, emerald. He frequently smelled like vanilla. As I lay on my side and stared at him, half curious, half afraid, I could see that Bourne had developed a startling collection of eyes that encircled his body. Each eye was small and completely different from the others around it. Some were human, blue, black, brown, green pupils, and some were animal eyes, but he could see through all of them. They perplexed me because I didn't know what they meant. I decided to think of it as a kind of odd adornment, Bourne's equivalent of a belt. When Bourne saw me staring at him, he would make a sound like the startled clearing of a throat, and his flesh would absorb all of the eyes, except two, which would migrate higher on his body and away from each other. Sometimes they would slip back down to his hips, but once in position on his torso, they became larger, took on a sea blue color, and grew long, dark lashes. They moved independent of each other. He must have thought he looked more normal that way. On the sixth day, I felt more lucid, woke with only a slight fuzziness. Wick had gone out again, reluctant, to conduct business. He hadn't found my attackers, and I knew he probably never would. We hadn't talked again about what had happened or about much of anything. I even pretended to be asleep when he came in. I had energy only for Bourne. From my bed, I asked Bourne a question. It was really the only question, a dangerous question to match a dangerous mood. I was still on the worm drugs, and I wanted to be of use, to do anything but just lie there. "What are you?" My heart beat faster, but I wasn't afraid, not really.
"I don't know," Bourne said in a rough yet sweet tone.
For a confused moment, I thought he'd spoken in the voices of both my parents at once. Then, sincere and eager,
"Do you know what you are?"
I ignored him. "Let's play a game to figure out what you are." Bourne went quiet for a second and his colors dimmed. Then he flared up.
"Okay," he said. "Okay.
Then you have to be honest with me."
"Honest,"
turning the word over in his head. "Tell the truth." A ripple of vibrant purple traveled across his skin.
"Honest. I can be honest. I am honest. Honest."
Had I upset him or triggered some other emotion, or was he just testing out the word? "You know a lot about me," I ventured, "but I know nothing about you. The game is about questions. Will you answer some questions?"
"I will answer questions," Bourne said, uncertain.
Did he understand the word question?
"Are you a machine?" I asked. "What is a machine?"
"A made thing, a thing made by people." This puzzled Bourne, and it was a long while before he said,
"You are a made thing. Two people made you."
"I mean something made of either metal or of flesh, but not through natural biological means."
"Two people made you. You are made of flesh," Bourne said.
He seemed agitated. Why didn't you save me from those boys?
Save?
Rescue. Help. Stop them from hurting me. There came a long pause, and everything about Bourne shut down until he was just a gray shape. Even the eyes went away. Then the colors came back in an explosion of reds and pinks and a roiling turbulent green. The eyes popped up as a rotating halo embedded in the skin near the top of his aperture.
But I did help! I helped! I helped, Rachel! I helped!
This said in an anguished tone. I tried to control the trembling of my voice. The spirit of Mord filled me up.
Those boys hurt me for hours!
I spat out the words.
Those boys did that, and you did nothing! They hurt me badly! And you could have done something.
Silence again. Then, in a whisper,
I could not. I did not help. Until.
Until what?
Until I knew them.
I realized knew wasn't the word he meant. That the word he sought might not exist. That he was trying, perhaps, to tell me two or three things at once.
Knew them how?
I am not complete, Bourne said. I was not complete. I am not complete.
He tried put together, which didn't help, finished his sentence with a kind of frustration for words that caused the feathery pseudopods to straighten like spikes.
Now you are complete? Aware?
I didn't want to use the word activated because it scared me.
More complete, Bourne said.
You killed them, I said, calm.
But not before they hurt me,
came the raging, screaming thought behind the words.
Kill?
Cease to be. No longer alive, dead, not here. Confusion shuddered through Bourne.
I know them now. I know them.
Killing is bad, I said. Killing should never happen. Don't kill. Unless someone attacks you. Unless you have to. But I didn't think to make the distinction to Bourne, because I didn't have the strength. Those eyes no longer seemed beautiful. They looked ever more trapped and horrible. Was it my imagination, or was one of them a familiar gray? I turned away from Bourne then and drifted into unconsciousness for a while. It was easier than facing what he'd said. And yet, why would I turn away unless I felt safe? The seventh night, I slept in Wick's quarters, and Mord, far above, slept over us, sprawled across the sea of loam and debris that covered the balcony cliffs. We experienced his breathing as a haunted depth charge that tumbled down through the layers, the beams and the drywall, the supporting columns and the cracking archways. The sound of it permeated the atoms of a dozen ceilings, vibrated through our bodies. We felt it in our flesh after we heard it in our ears, and it lingered longer under the skin. The stench came to us, too. Faint, carried by the ducts and the thousand imperfections in the sediment above us, carried by the subterranean tunnels of worms and beetles, like the thunder after lightning, it came to us late, but then wrapped around our throats. It was the stench of every living thing Mord had killed in the last week. Could Mord smell us down here? Could he smell us mice? Us little human mice? Wick lay frozen, unable to move, terrified that somehow this was not random, that Mord knew he was there, that come morning, Mord might start to root us out. And so, for a time, we whispered and moved in slow motion and in all ways acted as if we were submarines and moored a destroyer above seeking us. Even to whisper, Wick would put his mouth right up against my ear. He could not stop talking about rumors of moored proxies being seen, searching in the city and the hinterlands beyond. Searching for what? Wick wouldn't say. But I had the sense he knew. Then we didn't even whisper, as Mord began to moan in his sleep. His moans sounded like gnashed, crushed words filtered through the dirt, and we could not understand them. I knew only that they felt like anguish. Some hours later, we felt his weight leave us, the balcony cliffs almost seeming to spring back up around us with relief. When we examined the spot above in the morning, there was a deep depression from Mord's weight. If he had spent the whole night there, would he have fallen through, smashing down level by level until, still sleeping, his body bulged through our ceiling? The stench remained for a day or two, and whenever I smelled it, I felt a pressure pushing down on my head. I had come to Wick's place so he wouldn't come to mine and be reminded of Bourne. But Bourne is the subject he raised as soon as Mord had left. I almost wished Mord was still there to silence him.
I could still take him, Wick said.
Who? I asked, although I knew.
Bourne, it's time. I should just take him and figure him out while you recover.
You don't need to. He hesitated, about to say more, thought better of it, and seemed to accept what I had said. He hugged me close and, as if I were his shield against Mord, soon enough snored quietly against my shoulder. I let him, even though it hurt. The price of peace. Because it was simple. Because it helped us both. But I could not sleep. I was thinking about the silly conversations Bourne and I were having, because Bourne didn't seem to know much about the world, had only fragments that didn't quite fit together. Bourne. Why is water wet? Me. I don't know. Because it's not dry? Bourne. If something is dry, does that mean it's not wet? Me. Wet or wet? Bourne. Wet. Me. Wit is in the eye of the beholder. Bourne. What? I tried to explain wit to him. Bourne. Like grit in the eye? Is wit like dust? Me. Yes. Dry. Bourne. I'm thirsty. And I need a snack. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. Conversation would fall away again while I tried to find a snack for Bourne, which, again, wasn't hard. He especially liked what you might call junk food, even though that concept had become obsolete long ago. Maybe, too, I liked Bourne so much because Wick by then was almost always serious. For the longest time, Bourne didn't know what serious was. In the morning, with Mord and the weight of Mord just a bad dream, Wick tried again.
I can do it in a gentle way, he said,
but that didn't reassure me.
I can return him the way he is now.
No. His weight went taut against my back.
I shouldn't have to ask. You should know it's the best thing.
It's not.
You know something's not right, Rachel.
Now he was almost shouting. Like most men, Wick could not help terror about one thing erupting as anger about something else. So I said nothing, but he wouldn't let up.
Give me Bourne, he said.
I refused to turn to look at him.
You need to give him to me so we know what he is. He lives here among us.
and you protect him in a way that's unnatural. This thing you know nothing about.
No.
He may be influencing you using biochemicals, Wick said. You may not know your own mind.
I laughed at that, even though it could be true.
You have no right, Rachel, he said.
And there was a wounded quality to the word right. Tell me about your time at the company. I was tired of talking, just tired, period. Tell me all about your weird telescope. But he had nothing to say about his telescope. He had nothing else to say at all, and neither did I. We both knew that one word more, and either I would leave his bed, or he would ask me to leave.
Wick.
Wick and Rachel. Portrait of us. Wick and I, at opposite ends of the frame, half out of the picture. Oddly wary of each other now, for all that he took care of me, perhaps because he expected more blame from me, to bolster the guilt he had decided to keep. And perhaps I did blame him for making me weak, for making me rely on his surveillance, his beetles and spiders, rather than my own traps. Was that fair? No, it wasn't fair. But I had my own guilt. I now kept an even bigger secret from him. Bourne can talk. Bourne killed my attackers and hid their bodies. Bourne is intelligent. Bourne makes me happy. What I taught Bourne and what he taught me. Bourne made me happy, but happiness never made anyone less stupid. During my recovery, I had such trouble remembering what waited for me outside, as if I had to learn it all over again, despite having been taught so many lessons. All kinds of dangerous ideas entered my head while groggy. It was as if the little foxes and other animals out in the desert ran in circles around my mind, barking and kicking up dust, stopping only to stare at me from afar and encourage me to wander. I kept fantasizing that I lived in a real apartment in one of the stable sanctuaries from my past. Everything would be fine. I just had the flu or a cold and was out sick until I got better. And when I was better, what would I do? When I was better, I would go back to university and to some part-time job. I would complete my studies so I could become a writer. Because the ruined city was just a bad dream, and my life as a scavenger was a bad dream, and soon I would wake up, and the visions of almost drowning, of losing my parents, and with them all connection with the past, would prove to be an illusion too. The longer Wick expended time and energy protecting me, the more ideas like this took hold of me. They had only a vague relationship to my memories of flight, of trying to find refuge, of all the dangers before the city. But minds find ways to protect themselves, build fortifications, and some of those walls become traps. Even as I started to walk around my rooms with Bourne, even as I ventured out into the corridors, it was so sad a fantasy that I brushed by without recognition the revenants that told me it was a lie. The chair stuck in the wall. The filing cabinet rusted beyond use, now just a barricade at the mouth of a tunnel. The lack of libraries or other people. Yet those sequestered weeks also contained some of my best memories because of Bourne. Wick was gone a lot, spying on the magician's movements, providing beetles to his small band of dealers, and possibly because of our argument, which left Bourne and me ever more time to explore. He'd gotten tired of being cooped up in the apartment. On days when I knew Wick would be out for hours, I'd take Bourne into the hallways, prickly with the fear of discovery and stiff
from my slow-healing wounds. It was all a construct by then, this game of not telling Wick that Bourne could talk. He had to know. But because I never admitted it and Wick never brought it up, Bourne became an open secret that existed between us like a monster all its own. It made me reckless, as if I wanted Wick to confront me. That somehow our relationship would be a total lie if Wick didn't confront me. Ignoring the strain on my own body, Bourne and I would race down dim-lit, dust-covered corridors. Bourne, afraid of colliding / congealing with the wall and tripping over his own pseudopods, wailing as he laughed, "You're going too fast!" Or, "Why is this fun?" Which just made me laugh too. When you don't have to run and you have the chance to run for the hell of it, it becomes a strange luxury. Then we'd collapse at the end of the hall, and Bourne, in addition to his usual observation that he was hungry and needed a snack, I now let him hunt lizards and rats to blunt his appetite, would ask some of his questions. He never stopped asking them, as if he were really ravenous for the answers.
"This dust is so dry. Why is dust so dry? Doesn't it need some wet for balance?"
"Then it's mud."
"What's mud?"
"Wet dirt."
"I haven't seen mud yet."
"No, you haven't. Not yet." I would show Bourne a photo of a weasel in an old encyclopedia, and he'd point with an extended tentacle and say,
"Oh, long mouse."
Which brought me quickly to the idea of teaching Bourne to read. Except he picked that up on his own. When we played hide-and-seek, I'd sometimes find him hunched up on the edge of a midden of discarded books, two tentacles extending out from his sides to hold a book, and a single tentacle tipped with light curling down from the top of his head. He would study any number of topics and had no real preferences, his many eyes enthusiastically moving back and forth as he read the pages at a steady clip. I don't believe he needed light or eyes to read, but I know he liked to mimic what he saw me doing. Perhaps he even thought it was polite to seem to need light, to seem to need eyes. But the truth is, I don't really know what he thought or how he thought it, because most of the time, I just had his questions. Eventually, I took him to Wick's swimming pool, which was Wick's laboratory. I loved the swimming pool, and perhaps that meant I loved Wick too, in a way. The swimming pool had originally had a skylight above it, extending to the top of the balcony cliffs, and a divot of open space remained all the way to the top, with Wick contriving to camouflage it from above with his illusions. When the light from the hole in the ceiling was right, it formed green and gold waves, as if the moss and lichen on the surface had mingled with the sun's rays and been transformed in some fundamental way. The light would glisten against the living filaments Wick had placed there as part of his work, and you could see dust motes floating and the occasional water bug or glider, and, rising off the water, a mist that curled back on itself like certain kinds of ferns. It could take a while to get used to the melange of chemicals, which gave off a dank smell, cut through with something spicy. That spice could be sweet or sour, but was always sharp. Wick needed the light in the mornings to feed the rich, revolting, shimmering stew brew to finish his beetles and other creations. But our shit and piss fed it too. Although the harsh smell was more of algae and peat and some bitter chemical, I'd long ago gotten used to it, even found it pleasant. Eel-like things wriggled in the mire, and the fins of weird fish broke the surface, only to submerge again.
"What's a swimming pool?"
Bourne asked.
A place people go into to swim.
But it's full of disgusting things. Disgusting things live in there. Just disgusting. Really disgusting.
Disgusting was a word Bourne had just picked up and used often. Well, just leave those disgusting things alone, Bourne, even if you are hungry. I gently slapped away a tentacle he'd begun to inch toward the water. I had no idea what effect those chemicals would have on him, nor did I want Bourne eating Wick's supplies, which would only endear him further. Bourne summarized for me.
A swimming pool is a place where people like to swim in disgusting things.
Close enough, I said, chuckling. You won't be encountering many of those when you're out in the real world. And then I wished I hadn't said it, because I'd acknowledged that this wasn't the real world, that we lived in a bubble of space and time that just wouldn't last. I took him to the balcony out on the cliffs, too, but that was a little harder because I felt Bourne needed a disguise to be safe. I found a flower hat with just one bullet hole and a brown bloodstain to match. I found a pair of large designer sunglasses. I had the choice of putting him in a blue sheet or a black evening dress that I'd salvaged from a half-buried apartment. The evening dress was moth-eaten and had faded to more of a deep gray, but I chose it because I had nowhere to wear it and it was several sizes too big for me now. So Bourne reconfigured himself to be a little longer and less wide than usual, sucked in his stomach, more or less, and put on this ridiculous outfit. Only, on Bourne, it looked good. And it wasn't until later that I realized he'd drawn himself up into an approximation of my own body, that I was looking at a crude faux version of myself with green skin. But it wasn't complete enough for him.
What about shoes?
He asked me, and I regretted having gone off on a rant about the value of a good pair of shoes a couple of days before. You don't need shoes. No one will see your feet. Probably no one would see him, period.
Everyone wears shoes, he said, quoting me. Simply everyone. You even wear them to bed.
It was true. I'd never gotten over having to sleep in the open so often. When you slept in the open in dangerous places, you never took off your shoes in case you only had a few seconds to gather your things and take off running. Bourne really wanted shoes. He wanted the full ensemble. So I gave him shoes. I gave him my one extra pair, which were really boots, the ones I'd come to the city in. He made a great show of growing foot legs and with his hand arms reached down to put on his new shoes. He'd muted his skin to a shade that mimicked my own. From the aperture at the top of his head, muffled by the hat, came the words,
"We can go now."
But if Bourne wanted the full ensemble, I wanted the full human. "Not until you grow a mouth," I said, "and a real face."
"Uh-oh,"
he said, because he'd forgotten. In those days, he always said "uh-oh" when he felt he'd made a mistake. Maybe he was also trying to be a little difficult, a concept he'd been field testing, usually in charming ways. The transformation only took a second. All of his eyes went away. Then two popped up where appropriate. Never, ever gray anymore. And a nose protrusion that looked more like the head of the lizard he had eaten a few hours earlier, and a kind of crazy, grinning mouth. In that hat. In the black evening dress. In the boots. He looked so earnest that I wanted to hug him. I never for a second understood the gift I'd given Bourne. Never realized what other uses disguises could be put to. We went out on the balcony. Bourne pretended he couldn't see through his sunglasses and took them off. His new mouth formed a genuinely surprised O.
"It's beautiful," he exclaimed. "It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful."
Another new word. The killing thing, the thing I couldn't ever get over, is that it was beautiful. It was so incredibly beautiful, and I'd never seen that before. In the strange, dark sea blue of late afternoon, the river below splashing in lavender, gold, and orange up against the numerous rock islands and their outcroppings of trees, the river looked amazing. The balcony cliffs in that light took on a luminous deep color that was almost black, but not, almost blue, but not. The jutting shadows, solid and cool. Bourne didn't know it was all deadly, poisonous, truly disgusting. Maybe it wasn't to him. Maybe he could have swum in that river and come out unscathed. Maybe, too, I realized right then in that moment that I'd begun to love him. Because he didn't see the world like I saw the world. He didn't see the traps. Because he made me rethink even simple words like disgusting or beautiful. That was the moment I knew I'd decided to trade my safety for something else. That was the moment. And no matter what happened next, I had crossed over into another place. And the question wasn't who I should trust, but who should trust me. Part 2. How it had been, and what came next. The first time I saw Mord, it was twilight, 6 years before I found Bourne. On a day when I'd found nothing much except some autonomous meat quivering foul in a ditch next to a half-open storm grate. I knew a trap when I saw one. I marked the area with chalk to remember and made my way far to the west, to the remains of an abandoned highway covered over with lichen and rust and bone fragments. They formed a green-red-white pattern that almost looked purposeful. Not the good kind of lichen, or I would have harvested some for later. The high level of chemicals in the city's air has always made sunset a stirring sight, even if you were jaded, had become fatally distracted, or just had no room left for poetry. Orange and yellow melted in layers into blue and purple. I checked to the north and south, saw no one. I found a faded deck chair somewhere and sat in it, eating some stale crackers from the week before. My stomach was a tight, aching ball as I watched the sun go down. I was filthy from climbing through tunnels all day in the semi-abandoned factory district. I stank. I was exhausted. Despite my precautions, anyone could have seen me. Anyone could have attacked me. I didn't care. You had to let your guard down sometimes, or you forgot what that felt like. And I'd reached my limit for the week. That meat going to waste to bait a trap set by a crazy person, a cannibal, a pervert, it had gotten to me. Mord rose from the cluster of buildings directly ahead of me. At first, he was a large, irregular globe of dark brown against the orange edge of the sun. For one terrified moment, I thought he was an eclipse or a chemical cloud or my death. But then the eclipse began to move toward me effortlessly, blocking out the sun, destroying the sky, and I could see the great furred head in every detail. I couldn't run. I should have run, but I didn't. I should have leapt out of my deck chair and made for a drainage tunnel, but I didn't. I just sat in my deck chair with a cracker half in, half out of my mouth, and watched as the shadow of the behemoth stole over me. Back then, Mord wasn't as large, and he still lived in the company building. As he rose over me like a living dreadnought, his pelt was golden brown, pristine and clean-smelling, as if an army of company employees had done nothing but groom him for hours. His enormous eyes were bright and curious and curiously human, not as bloodshot and curved as they would later become. The smooth white of his fangs seemed less a bloody threat than the promise of a swift, clean execution. He luxuriated in the feel of the wind against his fur. I cannot fully explain the effect of Mord on me in that moment. As that silky, gorgeous head glided toward me, as his gaze slid over me and passed, with what seemed almost a secret amusement, as that pelt hovered mere feet overhead and the smell of jasmine came to me from his fur, and as I watched that whole vast body pass over me, I fought the urge to raise an arm to touch him. Some part of me could not decide if I was witness to the passage of a god or, perhaps out of hunger, a hallucination. But in that moment, I wanted to hug Mord. I wanted to bury myself in his fur. I wanted to hold on to him as if he were the last sane thing in the world, even if it meant the end of me. After Mord had passed me, I didn't dare look over my shoulder. I was afraid. Afraid he would be staring back with a ravenous look. Afraid I had conjured him up out of some dark need and he didn't really exist. How could Mord possibly fly? By what miracle or what damnation? I didn't know, and Wick had never offered up a theory. That Mord might once have been human, then, seemed like some distant, remote truth that lived on a mountaintop far from here. But it was this ability that made some in the city believe we had died and now existed in the afterlife, some purgatory or hell. And some portion of all of those who believed sacrificed themselves to Mord, and not by gaping at him from a lawn chair, munching on a cracker. Because if you were already dead, what did it matter? I sat there with the last of my crackers, as dusk settled over me and the stars made themselves known. Only after some time did I begin to shiver and take note of strange sounds coming closer and seek safety for the night. I had been in the city for a week. A week later, I would meet Wick. Soon after that, I would move into the balcony cliffs with him. Even knowing that Bourne had killed my attackers, even though I still knew too little about Bourne, I could not give in to Wick's judgment. Wasn't there so much that was good and decent in Bourne that I could bring out, no matter what I discovered about his purpose? This was the essential question that kept coming to me out of the darkness, even if I already had Wick's answer. I worked so very hard at accepting Bourne in the weeks that followed that I no longer saw him as odd. Even as he grew larger and larger, until he was taller than Wick, even as he kept trying out new shapes, changing from cone to square to globe, and then back again into his inverted squid pose. Wick was there almost all the time now, still taking care of me. I should have been more appreciative, but I resented his presence more and more. When he was around, Bourne had to be motionless, voiceless, eyeless, sitting there in the far corner while Wick and I talked. He resembled a giant question mark, and the way in which Wick never looked at Bourne made me know just how aware Wick was of my new friend. But even when Wick left, my conversations with Bourne continued to be halting and stilted at first. I had avoided the questions I had to ask at first, but then returned to them because I had no choice. I thought of myself as a shield against Wick, that Wick's questions would be more invasive, his conclusions harsher. I returned to the idea of Bourne as a machine. I found an old book amongst the wreckage and showed him a photo of a robot and then of a bioengineered cow. How we would long today to find a cow wandering the city. See? Like this. He reared up, exuding pseudopods as if they were coming out of his pores.
I am not a machine. I am a person. Just like you, Rachel. Just like you.
It was the first time I had ever done anything to offend him. I'd perplexed him, yes, but not offended him. I'm sorry, Bourne, I said. And I was sorry. I changed the subject a little. Do you know how you came to the city then?
I don't remember. There was water, a lot of water. And then I was walking, just walking.
No, I said patiently. That's my memory. That's something I told you. This kind of confusion happened more often than it should have. Bourne considered that for a second, then said,
I know things about things that are not mine, but it's mixed up. I mix it up. I am supposed to mix it up. In the white light.
I thought of the white light common to tales of death, of dying. I was in a tunnel. I saw a white light. What do you remember about the light? But he wouldn't answer that question. Defaulted to a common response that he thought pleased me.
I found myself when you picked me up. I was found by you. You plucked me. You plucked me.
The word pluck was new, but always and forever amused him. He could not tire of to pluck or plucked. He would make a sound like a chicken saying it, something I had taught him. Pluck, 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 and go running down the halls like a demented schoolboy. But this time when he said it, Bourne's voice got lower and lower, and he flattened himself across the floor next to my bed, as he did when talking about things that scared him. Do you know your purpose? I asked. Bourne's eye stalks, newly budded, and continually extending and then retracting into his body, all looked at me quizzically. The reason, I said, you know, the point of being alive. Were you made for a purpose? Does everything have a purpose, Rachel? His words got to me, sitting in the living room, looking up at the mold-stained ceiling. What was my purpose? To scavenge for myself and for Wick, and now for Bourne? To just survive and wait? For what? But I was trying to be a good parent, a good friend to Bourne. So I said, yes, everything has a purpose. And every person has a purpose or finds a purpose or a reason.
Am I a person?
Bourne said. And his eye stalks perked up and took special attention. I didn't hesitate. Yes, Bourne, you are a person. He was a person to me, but one already pushing on past to other concepts.
Am I a person in my right mind?
I don't know what you mean, I said, my standard ploy when I wanted time to think, with my right mind.
If there's a right mind, then there's a wrong mind.
I suppose so, yes.
How do you get a wrong mind? Is it born into you?
That's a tough question, I said. Usually I would have responded with something like, do you want a wrong mind? Or told him it could happen either way, born into you or through trauma. But I was too tired from repairing traps all day.
Is it tough because I already have a wrong mind?
No. Do you like to be silent sometimes? Bourne might be a person, but he was a difficult person because he probed everything.
Is silence because of a wrong mind?
Bourne asked. Silence is golden.
You mean because it's made of light?
How do you even speak with no mouth? I asked, but not without affection.
Because I'm not in my right mind?
Right mind, wrong mouth.
Is no mouth a wrong mouth?
No mouth is... But I couldn't stop from erupting into giggles. I saw these conversations as born playful. But really it was a youthful, still-forming mind that couldn't yet communicate complex concepts through language. Part of why Bourne couldn't is that his senses worked differently than mine. He had to learn what that meant. At the same time, he had to navigate the human world through me. The confusion of that, of finding unity in that, of basically becoming trilingual while living in the world of human beings, was very difficult. Always, as long as we knew each other, Bourne was offering up so many approximations, so many near misses on what he meant that might have meant other things. Much later, when I realized this, I went back over our conversations in my memory to see if I could translate them into some other meaning. But it was too late. They are what they are. They mean what they meant, and I know I misremember some of them anyway. And that pains me. The last night, before I would have to go out scavenging again, Wick came to check on me. It was perfunctory during this phase of our relationship, a duty and an obligation. Bourne went into what he would later call jokingly dumb mode or sucking in your gut. He drew in his eyes, got small, waddled to a corner, and sat there, immobile and mute. How are you? Wick asked from the doorway. The intensity of shadow hollowed out his cheekbones, and I felt as if I were being approached by a concept, an abstraction. Good, thanks, I said.
You'll be okay tomorrow.
Yes, I replied, although he'd not asked a question. Wick lingered there for a moment, eyes glinting like mineral chips, holding himself apart, distant. I didn't like to see him hurt by me, but I was stuck. He didn't have to be so adamant about Bourne. That was his fault. And I said nothing more. So he receded from me, back into the corridor, perhaps to go shove a memory beetle in his ear. Wick receded. Bourne blossomed. That was the way of it in those days. And in those days, too, the situation in the city had changed, and strange things were flourishing, and familiar ones withering. Since I'd last been outside, the magician had become a major force in the city. She now held an area in the northwest, starting roughly in a line extending out from where the company building's jurisdiction ended on the city's southern edge. A growing army of acolytes helped make her drugs and protected her territory against Mord and others. Wick had only his peculiar swimming pool, the bastion of the balcony cliffs, a scavenger woman who could make traps but kept secrets from him, and a creature of unknown potential that he desired to cast out. Worse, the rumored Mord proxies had finally made their presence known and seemed more bloodthirsty than their progenitor. They knew no rule of law, not even the natural law of sleep. Upon their appearance, as if there were some collusion between the proxies and the company, Mord spent several days huffing and puffing in front of the company building. Under his uncertain aegis, The company building was becoming more and more unstable and unsafe. Mord would sleep in front of it, and then other times he would forget his seeming role as protector and absentmindedly butt into the walls with his broad head. We could see that people still lived in the top levels, under siege in a way, as they were reduced to serving Mord's whims, while rumors came to us that beneath them, in the company's deepest levels, no one ruled at all. Despite these dangers, Wick had given me no refuge. We had an agreement, and I had to begin to honor my side of it again. I would go forth and scavenge. I didn't know if that was a mercy or a cruelty, or where that impulse came from in Wick. I didn't care. It was time to get out of bed. When Wick had gone, Bourne extended a tendril of an arm to take one of my hands in his own hand. A reasonable facsimile, if a little damp.
Rachel?
What, Bourne?
Do you remember what I said about the white light?
Yes.
Part of me had a nightmare about it while your friend was here.
I checked myself from asking all of the questions I could have asked. Part of me? Just now you were asleep?
You have dreams?
I had learned that when Bourne used this tone of voice, he was about to trust me, was sharing something important. What kind of nightmare? I asked. How did he know the word nightmare? I hadn't taught it to him. He hadn't used it before.
I was in a dark place, only it was filled with light. I was alone, only there were others like me. I was dead. We were all dead.
Not alive? Sometimes Bourne said that something was dead if it didn't move, like a chair. Or a hat.
Not alive.
Like a heaven or a hell?
Rachel, said with soft admonishment. Rachel, I don't know what those things are.
I didn't know either. How could I know? Talking to a cheery monster, living in a hole in the ground, among too many broken things. I laughed, as much to dispel that thought as because anything was funny. Never mind, it's religion, which I can teach you. Never. My parents hadn't been religious, and I'd learned from the Mord cults that religion in the city wasn't about hope or redemption, but about tempting death.
Okay,
Bourne said, and his eyes formed a kind of reproachful smile.
I don't always understand, Rachel. I love you, but I don't understand.
Love? He just admitted he didn't know about heaven and hell. What could he know from love? I pushed forward past it. And what happened next?
I tried to wake up. I tried to wake us all up, but I couldn't. I couldn't because I was dead. That's the word, dead. And I needed to wake up because a door was opening.
Door, to Bourne, could, again, mean many things that were not doors. What happened when the door opened? I asked.
They would make me go through the door. I don't want to go through the door, and not just because I am dead.
What's on the other side of the door? I asked. All of Bourne's many eyes turned toward me, like rows of distant glittering stars against the deep purple earth tones of his skin. For the first time in a long time, I felt as if I didn't know him.
Because I am dead, I do not know what is on the other side of the door.
That is all that he would say.